Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and returning for a third visit to the book club, letterer extraordinaire and easily the most goth man in any room that he's in, it's Jim Campbell. Welcome back, Jim.
Hello, Eamon. It's a delight to be back, to be honest. It's been a little while. I've been looking forward to it.
Well, we've done some Strontium Dog Journey to Hell. We did House of Damon. We talked about meeting up at Thought Bubble to do this recording face-to-face, which I couldn't make work for family logistical reasons. But we did meet at Thought Bubble last weekend and managed to have a pint in the bar in the evening. How did you get on at Thought Bubble?
Pretty good, actually. I mean, it was a little bit crowded on Saturday for me, because we're still post-COVID.
Very crowded.
Yeah. I think that's the busiest I've seen it. I mean, everybody I've spoken to said that they did really well on the Saturday. And somebody told me that the 2000 AD store was running out of merch by mid-afternoon on Saturday. So
it did, yes, apparently. Yeah.
So I'm pleased it seemed to have been a roaring success. A number of people commented, I think they put it back a week from normal, I think, because they're in danger of running into Remembrance Sunday, and I think they felt it might be slightly inappropriate to have Darth Vader and Stormtroopers stomping up and down Harrogate High Street on Remembrance Sunday. So they put it back a week, and a lot of people commented it was noticeably colder just for being that week later.
Yes.
But it was absolutely freezing. So
yeah, if you stepped out of the convention halls, it got very cold very quickly, didn't it?
The choice of North Yorkshire.
Yes, true. This is true. What can we expect? Anyway, so splendid stuff at Thought Bubble, and I'm delighted we managed to meet up for a drink in the bar. Now, tell us, third visit to the book club, what's the book we're going to be talking about today?
From the pages of Eagle, we're doing Tower King.
Great stuff, by Alan Hebden and Jose Ortiz. As you say, the new Eagle comic, the second one, issues 1 to 24, were in March to September 1982, edited by Dave Hunt at the time. This was collected by Hibernia Press. I've got a date of 2014, which I think I've taken from Lee Gallagher's introduction, although I noticed that my copy is one of their reissues. I think they did a reprint in October 2020, which is the one I've got. Occasionally, Hibernia do put out a reissue of something that seems quite popular. So
I have a feeling they might have done a short run with a spine like they did with House of Damon as well.
Ah, right. Okay.
As opposed to the sort of magazine format, which is more than one, I think we've both got.
Well, no, I think I've got the spine one. You've got the sort of magazine one, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, why the Tower King for the book club, Jim?
Well, I think it was basically directly a result of doing House of Demon, as both being in raptures over Jose Ortiz's artwork. And I thought, well, that's the sort of, this is just another significant chunk of his work, given that he didn't really, I don't think he ever really sort of got a decent bite of the apple at 2000 AD. I mean, apart from a fairly unloved chunk of Rogue Troopers history, and the odd Future Shock and stuff, I don't think he did a huge amount of stuff for them. So it's quite nice to find a decent chunk of his work in English, and it sort of showcases so many of his multitude of talents. So
it does indeed, yeah. We will be, once again, I think, waxing lyrical in a moment about Jose Ortiz's artwork. So give us the setup. For anybody who hasn't been able to go back to those New Eagle copies from the early 80s or managed to get a Hibernia Press collection, what is the Tower King, or who is he, and what is the situation he's facing?
But the Tower King himself is this splendidly named Mick Tempest.
Great name.
And he's called the Tower King because he lives in the Tower of London, which he has taken, turned into a fortress after a malfunctioning satellite makes electricity generation impossible across the entire planet, and things very rapidly descend into some sort of feudal mix of post-apocalyptic and medieval kind of thing going on there. So there's literally no electricity, and the planes fall from the skies, and amusingly, it says that all the nuclear reactors melt down, but there's surprisingly few people dying of radiation sickness. You'd have thought the entire planet would be poisoned if all the nuclear reactors melted down simultaneously, but we'll gloss quickly over that one and move on.
So it's a post-apocalyptic tale. He's leading this group of people in the Tower of London. He is the Tower King. What about some of the threats that him and his community have to face over these 24 issues?
Well, I mean, they are many and various, to be honest with you. You have, I mean, as with most comics, but particularly with Alan Hebden, it doesn't hang about. I mean, the entire apocalypse takes place in the first two pages of episode one, And it's just like, all right, well, you know where you are now. Everything's gone to hell. Let's get on with it, which is quite engaging. So, yeah, I mean, we've got there's the tube rats who are mutated in some way and live in the underground. And then it's just literally, it's a rolling procession. I mean, you know, we meet them on page three, because these are only, apart from the first episode, I think they're all three-page episodes. So it literally is like, you know, introduce the threat at the end of one episode, repel it in the middle, and introduce another one by the end of the next three pages. So we've seen off the tube rats by the end of episode one, but then slightly Viking-looking medieval knights on horseback who all disembark from a steam train in episode two, and it's literally just rolls on and on and on with sundry sort of, as I think as Hebden's trying to work out sort of what he can conceivably use as a threat that doesn't run on electricity. So we've got horses, we've got steam trains, we've got steamrollers, we've got, well, much later on, we've got chieftain tanks running on diesel, so that's all okay. And, you know, it is literally just every episode seems to be Alan trying to work out, what else can I do that doesn't involve electricity? Oh, we can have artillery and we can have steamrollers and we can have steam engines. And it's, you know, it's just absolutely paced like a rocket with this sort of rolling cascade of different threats. I mean, we end up back in the underground for a bit, and
it's Conrad and I often talk about how after the apocalypse, particularly in Australia, but in North America to a certain degree, there's this idea that everybody's immediately shaves their head into a mohawk, wears punk clothing and chains and leathers and starts riding motorbikes. Here in this British apocalypse, it sort of immediately turns back to the medieval times.
Yes, it's quite determinedly medieval. Everybody's in plate or chainmail armor, and that's very much where it's taken its influence on, which is quite nice for a sort of a post-apocalyptic story in a ostensibly science fiction setting. Because to be honest with you, I mean, if you take the apocalypse out, it's not really very science fiction-y at all.
Yeah,
it's just an adventure story. I mean, you could have done a lot of this in a pseudo historical setting for it. But you know, that robs you of the joys of doing things like all the sequences in the underground, and of course you can't have chieftain tanks turning up. So.
So Alan Hebden's writing, obviously best known to us probably for Meltdown Man in 2000 AD, but also we've covered El Mestizo and Major Easy on the pod as well. So, you know, well known for those. What do you make of his, as you say, frenetic three pages an issue storytelling as he rattles through this?
I mean, as with Alan, you know, all Alan stuff, you know exactly what you're going to get. Some of it probably that you don't have to think about too much, as it probably wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. But it doesn't really matter because it's going so fast, and everything just whips right past you, and you kind of go, oh great, and you know, you just sat there taking in these ludicrously elaborate kinds of peril, all beautifully rendered by Ortiz, and it's absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful stuff. I mean, I think, how many pages does he get for the first episode to set it up? I think he gets four pages, yeah.
And then it's three pages right the way through.
Yeah. And as you said, he destroys the world in two pages to begin with, and then sets out the medieval theme for the rest of it. And then there's this variety of threats that are going to come for the Tower King and his community, as I say, plus various people that he sort of acquires and adopts as he goes along. A couple of orphan kids that he's very fond of towards the end of the book and looking after. Spencer, his invaluable second-in-command. Great stuff from Alan Hebden.
I thought that was quite a neat turnaround by Hebden, actually, the fact that he looks like he's going to be a villain for at least the first three or four episodes. And then there's a terrific, then they get attacked by the tube rats, and there's a terrific splash picture of about four episodes in with them. Tempest is about to be beheaded, and then these tube rats attack, and there's a picture of him struggling with the guys who are trying to take him to the chopping block whilst all these mutants sort of swarm up behind him. It's all terrific, but it's just another one of the standouts. But I quite like the turnaround there, where you're definitely working towards him being the villain, Spencer being the villain, for at least the first four episodes. And then it's kind of like, oh, actually, do you know what? There's much worse things out there than either of us. And we don't want to both get killed. I think it's time to work together. Which, you know, it was neat. I wasn't expecting it. You know, I was just expecting, you know, Tempester to do his thing and for Spencer to get his just desserts. So
Alan Hebden, obviously, still with us. I've got a very fond memory of meeting him at a table, sitting with Steve McManus at Lawless a few years ago, where I got him to sign a copy of Meltdown Man, and found, much to our delight, that he and Steve McManus are still arguing a bit about the title of that story, which is delightful.
I didn't know that. Yes. You didn't know that. What did Alan want it to be called, or what did Steve want it to be called?
So Steve chose the title Meltdown Man, which Alan thought had got very little to do with the story he wrote. I can't remember what Alan's title for it was. But yes, he said, oh, that I didn't like the title. That was his idea. And then sort of passed it to Steve to sign as well.
Well, I mean, it is a little bit strange, because I think the thinking behind it was that he was expected to get melted down by the nuclear explosion that happens in the first episode. And then, apart from being the MacGuffin that kicks the story off, is never referred to again. So it's kind of like, that thing ran for 50 episodes.
Yeah.
So if you came into it in episode 18, it is a slightly bizarre title, because you kind of go, well, where's the Meltdown Man? Who's doing the melting and why? And it's absolutely nothing to do with the story. So Tara King at least doesn't have that problem. It does actually, you know, does what it says on the tin.
Indeed. Yes, exactly. He is the Tower King. He's going to have all sorts of medieval conflicts with a variety of wreckers and other raiders, tube rats and so on. So great stuff from Alan. Let's turn to the artwork, because we want to talk about, as ever, Jose Ortiz, born 1932, sadly passed away in 2013. The Tower King, House of Damon, the 13th Floor, and as you say, that perhaps not the most fondly remembered run on Rogue Trooper, but I don't think that was his fault.
Absolutely not.
So this is black and white. Tell us a little bit about the artwork on the Tower King and what Jose Ortiz is doing here.
Well, I mean, the first thing I notice is he's actually quite a lot more constrained here than he would be when he goes on the House of Damon, which is, there's a much higher panel count. I mean, I think it's not at all uncommon to have sort of 8-9 panel pages, whereas I think Wagner and Grant gave him a bit more room to breathe on House of Damon. So this is perhaps sort of not quite as showy, simply because he doesn't have the space. He's got to get on and tell the story. But that doesn't change that. It's absolutely terrific. His penmanship's wonderful. And he's got this, as with the House of Damon story, he's got this lovely grey wash going on as well. I mean, I was interested to... I genuinely hadn't made the connection until I read Lee Gallagher's introduction when he says about how much he was influenced by him. And once he says it, you go, of course he was. You can right. clearly see it when it's pointed out to you. But it surprised me that I hadn't spotted it myself. But it's quite an obvious... debt without being sort of a copy or anything. You can clearly see it in the heavy blacks and the way that he approaches the sort of the hatching and the rendering in the inks, because it's very, very, Ortiz is a master at doing both very well lit scenes and also very, very dark ones, and with a bonus that you never ever are confused as to what's going on.
Yeah,
which I think is just, you know, I mean, people underrate clarity, because you don't notice it if they're doing it properly. You only notice it when you have to stop over a panel and go, what exactly is going on here? And you literally never have to do that with anything I've ever seen by him.
You always get a very good sense of who's where and where the action, what the action is, and the movement through the panel.
And the space and the whole sort of environment, which he doesn't skimp on either. I mean, you know, he's when he drops a background, it's usually for a specific purpose, rather than you get the impression that he couldn't be bothered. You know, he was in a hurry. The environments are beautifully realised. And one of the things I noticed about him, I might have mentioned this last time I was on, is the daylight scenes. I always think there's a very specific kind of light to them. I thought this when I saw him do with his Rogue Trooper as well. It kind of feels like a Western. There's something about a very strong, very harsh daylight.
Yes.
And he likes a bounce light as well, so there's a secondary light source. And it feels very distinct. I can't think of another artist who I could identify by the way that they light their figures. But Ortiz, it's so distinctive. And, of course, his figure work, along with everything else, is terrific. He was a superb draftsman.
Absolutely. And I know we're going to be talking about it later on when we get to Grail Pages, but his faces are so full of character and emotion, and some of the close-ups are just wonderful, aren't they?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, every single character is distinct. They, as you say, they ooze character as well. So you know, Tempest is steely, and Spencer's a bit sort of bald and flabby and ineffectual. And some of the grotesques are really grotesque. And it's terrific stuff. There's so much character in it, and so much. It moves. Do you know what I mean? The movement is palpable as well, which is not always the easiest thing. There's no sense of stiffness that, you know, everybody looks like. Well, you sort of believe that they're living a very difficult life in a very difficult place because they all look like they're ready to leap into action at a moment's notice.
Yeah,
because of the constant level of threat that they're exposed to.
And it's fascinating from Lee, as you say, from Lee Gallagher's introduction that he was sort of like stuck. He found himself a bit stuck artistically, and then sought out as much Jose Ortiz work as he could, and took influences from his pen and brush style. And, you know, it sort of reinvigorated Lee Gallagher and his career as well, which is fascinating.
It is. And like I say, until I read the introduction, I had no idea. But once you read it in black and white, you kind of go, oh, yeah, of course.
And that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, he mentions brushwork because, as you say, he's doing what appears to be grey wash to apply textures and depth on the armours and the figures and so on, making the Tempest King's sort of leather scale mail really stand out.
Yeah.
I presume that is what he's doing. It is like a brush wash on this.
That would be my first thought. I did, when in my youth, I did rather foolishly attempt something similar. I'm pretty sure, yeah, it's literally just watered down ink to create various grey tones and right. applied with a brush, I'm pretty sure. On which point, I think we should probably make our traditional singing the praises of Hibernia, and especially Richard and the Repro team.
Yes.
Because obviously Eagle wasn't printed on the best paper. And you've got these these washers, which would have been rendered as tones made out of dots, in a fairly coarse manner for the paper that Eagle was printed on. And you know, you wouldn't know that these have been scanned from a not particularly well printed comic. I mean, it was slightly better than the toilet paper that they were printing 2000 AD on at the time, which because I think the photo strips demanded it.
But it wasn't
the best quality paper, and it wasn't the best quality reproduction, and. You know, you really wouldn't know that this had been scanned from, a fairly sort of, you know, low budget comic, because it's a terrific bit of repro.
That's Richard Pierce and of course David MacDonald at Hibernia Press, yeah. Who, as you say, have produced another beautiful collection of, again, perhaps one of the sort of like shorter runs or more obscure comics that the Treasury probably wouldn't reprint, and they've done this, the Tower King, and it just looks lovely, doesn't it? All the pages appear pin sharp and splendid.
I mean, yes, if anybody hasn't seen it, I'm assuming you could probably scrounge a copy up on eBay if you were patient, and it's absolutely worth it.
Yeah. I mean, as ever, the only problem with Hibernia Press is that they're limited print runs, and they don't keep them in print for long, so you have to get them while they're there before they move on to something else, which we'll perhaps talk about towards the end of this episode as well. But yeah, I mean, wonderful stuff.
It would be quite nice. I was just thinking, imagine if Treasury of Comics are listening, I think if you slapped House of Damon and Tower King into one book, you'd have enough for a reasonable sized tome.
Yes, this is true. And of course, House of Damon, in terms of dates, comes straight after this.
It does, yes.
That he moved on to next, wasn't it, Jose Ortiz? With that's a Wagner and Grant one, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. Yeah, the Jose Ortiz artwork is just wonderful, and I will come back at some point to talk to you about some Grail pages and some particular favourite moments in a moment. We've got you here, obviously, Jim. Take advantage because there's the lettering. Now, there are no credits on the pages. I see Jose Ortiz has managed to get his signature in a couple of places, which is always...
When he gets the luxury of a splash page, he normally manages to sneak his signature in there somewhere. So
yeah.
or even just a big panel rather than a splash page. There's never anything as indulgent as an actual splash page in the whole thing. So
yeah. What can you tell us about the lettering on the Tower King, Jim?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming it's been done the way it was always done at this point, which is physically stuck to the artwork. So I've never seen any Ortiz originals knocking around. But if you did turn one up, I would expect the lettering to be physically attached to the pages, because it was done onto adhesive-backed paper.
Right.
So the letterer would do the balloons and write them all out on this adhesive-backed paper, then cut them out with a pair of scissors or a scalpel, and then add the balloon tails directly onto the artwork with white paint.
Ah, okay.
And it's one of those things that, unfortunately, the adhesive on the back of the balloon paper tends to soak through over the years. So when you see artwork of this vintage with the lettering still attached, it's why the balloons tend to be more or less transparent or very brown.
Yes, yes. And I think we've all seen that on originals. The stuck-on balloons do age differently to the rest of the page, don't they?
It's also, and to be honest, also it's quite amusing when they move to a different pen for the bolds, because sometimes the actual writing changes colour as well. So the pen that they used for sort of normal lettering will fade to one colour, and the thicker pen that they used for the bold lettering had a different ink and will fade to a completely different colour. It quite often goes red, which is interesting.
Right. Oh, okay. And what about, I mean, this is hand-lettered, of course. Would there be any other sort of particular techniques or guides they were using to guide the lettering?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't know whether the editorial team provided placement guides for where they specifically wanted the balloons to go, or whether it was just left to the letterer's discretion. I did do some work in comics, not quite at this time, maybe a couple of years later, when hand lettering was still the norm.
Mm.
And I have seen some strips go out with a set of photocopies that the editors marked up the balloon positions onto. But I'm not sure whether that was the case at Fleetway or IPC at the time.
Right.
The other thing I will also mention is if you ever see the original artwork, you'll tend to find, if you ever see a panel with an open background and very little going on, or a plain white background, you'll tend to find that the letter just letters straight onto it because it's quicker.
Ah, okay, right. So otherwise, as you say, they've got the stick-on balloons, which
is a little bit of a fanny. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, because it's kind of specific to British comics, this doing it all on sticky paper, because obviously in the States the penciler and the inker are usually two separate people.
Yes.
So what used to happen was the pencils would go to the letterer would put the lettering onto the pencils, and then it would go off to the inker, who would ink round it. And so they could letter directly onto the artwork. But because in the UK it was very unusual to have a separate penciler and inker, the pages would arrive at editorial complete, and so they had to come up with a way of doing it that could apply the lettering to finished artwork, because obviously you couldn't just sort of draw it straight onto the page and then get the inker to finish round it.
Right, gotcha, okay. I mean, we don't know who the letterer was, of course.
Most of it is by Steve Potter.
Oh, right, okay. Well, well done. You can spot the hand.
I can recognise immediately.
Right.
In fact, the bulk of it is by Steve Potter. There's a couple I don't recognise. I mean, Steve does like first two, episode three, it changes.
Right.
And that's either Peter Knight or John Aldrich, who I can never tell apart because they had quite similar lettering styles. And then it quickly goes back to Steve Potter, and then he does another chunk, and then it goes back to either Knight or Aldrich. Although there's one episode towards the end that is either Knight or Aldrich, but it's the other one, if you see what I mean.
Right, okay.
Because they're similar but different, and I didn't see enough of their work back in the day to sort of have imprinted on my brain which of them was which. I just know that they both lettered in a very similar style, but not identical. This is sort of nerdy thing that letterers like me get quite excited about, but
right.
Nobody else really, really, really cares, but we do.
Well, I'm always fascinated that you can spot the hand of these classic letterers, Jim. I guess you've just, with your experience, you've just got used to being able to tell who these are. I guess you can spot them.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, it's no different to being able to tell who's done the inks on a page, or
right.
You know, the way that they approach the actual writing, although it's not handwriting, they all have very specific quirks. you know, and so Steve Potter doesn't look anything like Tom Frame, for example. You know, sure. You can spot them a mile off. And it was always slightly weird when Steve would fill in on a Judge Dredd episode, because that strip was so heavily dominated by Tom's lettering style that it actually looked slightly odd when somebody else did it.
Right. Of course, Tom Frame, as you say, he was like the definitive Dredd letterer for so long.
Yeah, I mean, it's from sort of the very early days of the strip through to, was it 2002 we lost it, I think?
I was going to say, yeah, it's up to around about 2000, wasn't it? Yeah. Speaking of Dredd, I noticed there's a panel in the very last episode of this story where Tempest is looking directly towards us with his rifle and says, "The crime was murder, the punishment is death." A very Judge Dredd moment towards the end.
Yes, absolutely.
Which reminds me, it sort of wraps up fairly quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, that is the one sort of fly in the ointment, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you get the distinct impression that Alan was running out of steam. I mean, the whole of the preceding episode is basically just Tempest sliding down a wire.
Yeah.
Which is you know, fairly low key and a little bit overextended. You get the impression at that point, it's sort of like, really, really, Alan? So this is an awful lot, two whole pages of somebody sliding down a wire.
Yeah.
And then literally, the first two panels of the next episode, a meteorite strikes the satellite that's been suppressing all the electricity generation on the planet, and everything leaps back into life, which is
okay.
So apparently somebody's been feeding that power station with coal the entire time the apocalypse has been ongoing, the post-apocalypse has been ongoing, as it's still running, apparently. It just wasn't producing any electricity, which is remarkable.
Yeah. obviously he didn't plan any sequel to this because he thought, no, I'm just going to wrap this one up and move on to the next thing.
One thing I did notice towards the end, it just struck me as being a bit of a recurring theme through sort of British comics at the time, is that Tempest gets branded, he gets disfigured.
He does, yes. He gets,
and it's quite a recurring theme that they're very much outsiders.
Right.
The heroes in comics, they're disfigured or they're loners or there's something going on that makes them stand apart from the crowd. And they're very often sort of defenders of a community that doesn't really like them very much, which is another running theme. And I'm wondering if sort of the outsider thing is just sort of a mirror of all the punk stuff where people are very, very emphatically trying to be different from the crowd. But also, obviously, would simultaneously appeal to nerdy, lonely little boys who had nothing better to do with their time than read comics.
Yeah. He is branded on his forehead with the insignia of Southern Electricity.
Yes.
Which must make consumers of that power company look at this with a certain ironic smile, I should imagine. Yes.
I shouldn't harp on about the ending because it is literally just the end. It's the final episode of what is a hugely entertaining 24 episode run. So,
yeah, great stuff. Well, it is fantastic, The Tower King. I mean, it is only 24 episodes, so it's a fairly quick read, which, you know, in a way is a relief from some of the long stuff we've had to read for the pod. But yeah, it's just terrific because you've got Jose Ortiz's artwork throughout it and just wonderful. Any memorable moments or episodes for you, Jim, before I ask you about Grail Pages?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, every couple of episodes, there's something where you just go, oh, that's great. I mean, that's absolutely terrific. I mean, you know, I mentioned, you know, there's the mutated tube rat attacking while he's already being threatened with decapitation, which is quite an entertaining level of threat. You know, and a couple of episodes later, you've got the tube rats swarming up out of the underground, which he's just flooded, which again is just quite striking,
yeah.
And it just rolls on and on and on. I mean, every time. I mean, I'm looking at a page just now that's the end of an episode. It's probably getting over halfway through the book, where it's the last page of an episode where the plague has descended on them, and there's just all these bodies stacked up in the largest panel on the page, and then directly below that there's a couple of dozen horses, which would cause many artists to have a minor conniption.
Yeah, but not Jose Ortiz, apparently.
It seems to tackle it all with aplomb. So yeah, and then we've got steamrollers turning up the episode after. We've got steamrollers versus horses. You know, it's deliriously quickly paced. And no sooner they seen all the steamrollers than the chieftain tanks arrive. And you kind of go, oh, God, blimey, Alan, calm down a bit.
I'm looking at the first page of, I think, the fifth episode, which is where Tempest is wearing a sort of hooded cloak and he's been stalked by tube rats. And the first three panels of that page.
Oh, yes.
Are just, you can see Jose Ortiz's 1970s creepy work there, you know. It's like a wonderful horror moment, those three panels.
No, that is terrific, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now and thinking I should have chosen that Grail page.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? My selection was fairly arbitrary because in the end I'd got this list and I was going to say, well, you could probably just do all the pages.
Yes, any page from The Tower King by Jose Ortiz. I looked on Comic Art Fans and there is a Jose Ortiz artwork on there, but. I couldn't see any Tower King pages. So if anybody knows whether these pages survive and who owns them, please do get in touch and let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't seen an awful lot of In the Wild either, to be honest.
Right.
I mean, not this specific story, an awful lot of Ortiz artwork in the wild. It doesn't seem to... Obviously, Dean never really had a sort of a huge profile in this country, so perhaps there just wasn't the demand for it. And of course, we can't rule out the possibility with IPC being what they were. The chunk of it ended up in a skip somewhere, so...
Yeah, possibly. So let's assume it all survived and we could grant you any page from this collection, and any page would probably do us, but you have got a particular page in mind, Jim.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I very much ummed and ahed over the third page of the first episode.
Right.
Because that's got a terrific hero shot of Tempest himself. And then you've got tube rats swarming up out of the underground. You've got guys in armor on horses and, you know, That's a lot of storytelling going on there. But in the end, I picked one sort of quite a long way into the tank battle that rages for about four episodes. As I say, you said you haven't got any page numbers, but I've got it as page 42, which just has one of Ortiz's just absolutely terrific grotesque faces at the top of the page, and then an absolutely lovely rendering of a chieftain tank in the middle, and then the ground opening up and swallowing it at the bottom, which is, you know. You know, there's a lot going on there, and it still manages to be absolutely lovely. But like I said, I would certainly have taken just about any page in the entire book and quite happily stuck it on my wall. Which one were you leaning towards?
Well, before we leave your page, we'll just say that Jose Ortiz is wonderful at sort of grotesque faces.
Yes.
First panel is marvellous. The middle panel of the page with the sort of side-on view of the chieftain tank, you mentioned the lighting and the fact that it almost seems like a Western, because that looks like it could almost have been filmed in Monument Valley or...
Yeah, you see what I mean about there's a very specific quality to his light. I can't think of another artist I associate that association with so automatically.
Yeah. It's very interesting that you said that now, because looking at that panel, I think, oh, yeah, exactly that. I'll post that picture, obviously, when this episode comes out in December. I will post those three panels of the tube rats stalking the cloaked Tempest. But I've chosen towards the end in their battles, I think it's with the Southern Electricity, there's a boat scene where Tempest and two orphan kids are in this boat. As ever, it's an opening title page, so I get the logo. Being fired on, the boat's overturned, and I just loved Ortiz's work on the boat itself. Great action shot, Tempest King flying out of the boat in his armor, and then you get water, you get the kids sort of almost drowning. And again, in the background of that panel, again, it looks like the Western setting.
Yes, it does.
Even though the caption tells us England, late 1980s, generation of electricity is impossible on Earth. Yeah. So that's my page, Jim. But yeah, yours is absolutely fantastic. And now that I'm thinking about the lighting techniques, it makes it even more interesting. But as you say, his faces throughout this are just wonderful, aren't they?
Oh, no, I mean, there's so much character and so much action and so much movement. And then it's also gorgeously rendered as well. It's a terrific piece of work.
Yeah.
So definitely, Treasury of British Comics, do an Ortiz book, slap this together with House of Damon, and I reckon you'd have probably about 120, 140 pages. I can't remember. I think House of Damon ran to about 18 episodes.
Right.
And think that was might have been 4 pages an episode. I can't remember now. I haven't got a copy to hand. But so I reckon you'd have a solid 120, possibly 140 pages of absolutely gorgeous grey wash Ortiz artwork.
And they have been putting out some artist focus books. I've forgotten who the latest one is. Is it Munoz that they've just done a collection?
Yeah, I think
of?
You're right, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, you might be right. They might do an Ortiz collection for us. And, you know, David McDonald and Richard Pierce have done lots of the heavy lifting for them already. So,
well, exactly, yeah. Yeah. You know, the main stumbling block is the, you know, the lack of original artwork and the state of the printing. But, you know, David and Richard have done a cracking job with the reprint both those stories. So it'd be lovely to just get, you know, a nice chunky hardcover, especially would be my vote. But
we'll have a hardback for the shelf. Yes, absolutely. So as you've said already, Jim, you're going to have to go to eBay if you want to try and get a copy at the moment, unless we can persuade the Treasury to do an Ortiz collection. You should still go to comicsy.co.uk/Hibernia to see what their latest books they've got, which are still available. And I noticed that they've just done issue 6 of the Fleetway Files, which is Slave of the Screamer by Tom Tully and Jesus Blasco, which I have here in front of me as well. As we always say with Hibernia Press, you've got to get them while they're out because limited print runs, and when they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally they rediscover a small box of them or do another very short run. But yeah, you can't rely on any of that. You've got to just get in there, grab it while you can. Yeah. And they always do such a terrific job. I mean, I'm my hat is off to them. I've done sort of bits of repro over the years, working from less than ideal source material, and I know how difficult it is. I mean, I used to work in newspapers and do a lot of design and production, and it's a real skill, and yeah. they always produce a quality product. So yeah, my hat is most definitely off to them.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic stuff by them. You know, we can't say enough about the quality of the Hibernia Press collections, and just get them while you can. Keep an eye on what the latest is and get them for your shelf.
Definitely, and they deserve all the support we can give them as well, because it's clearly a labor of love for them, and it's so nice to be able to get stuff. You know, you unless you've got a original run of the first half year of Eagle, there's just no way of accessing this material. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's the only other place to find them, of course, is to get the first 6 months' worth of the Eagle. Right. Great stuff. Well, let's turn to guest projects, Jim. After having appreciated Jose Ortiz and Alan Hebden's work on The Tower King and also the work of Hibernia Press, what about your own work? What have you got out at the moment? What can you tell us about?
Well, I continue to beaver away for Tharg the Mighty on the 2000 AD and the magazine, which is sort of is my day-in, day-out work. It's a little bit tricky to talk about anything else because I'm doing quite a lot of work for Dark Horse at the moment. And bless them, Dark Horse work so far in advance of the publication date, I never know when the things are going to come out.
Oh, okay.
The books I'm working for at the moment, I don't think any of them have even been announced yet. So it's quite awkward. So, and the thing is, the books that then come out are so long ago that I've forgotten that I worked on them until I see the announcement that they're going on sale. So it's a slightly weird position because I feel quite disconnected from it because there's so much time between me doing the work and the product actually appearing. So I would urge people to go and check out the stuff I'm doing in 2000 AD. That's really good fun.
Yes, absolutely. You know, great that you're still working for the Mighty One. Yeah, he keeps you busy. I noticed, I mean, I was wearing at Thought Bubble, I was wearing the Tom Foster Dread T-shirt, which I'd got from the 2000 AD web store. And, of course, for that image, they've added a Your Next Punk speech bubble. And that was you, I gather.
That was me. I think there's two or three of the new T-shirts that have got lettering on. I did all of them. So,
Oh, right. Okay. You help them out when they need some lettering for one of these new T-shirts they're doing, which is great.
It's a genuine little thrill to see them actually sort of on somebody's person as well. So
yeah, I don't know if you can see on the webcam, I'm actually wearing it today, Jim. So
terrific, excellent. Yeah. What I like to see.
Yeah, and also your guide to lettering, your various guides to lettering, can still be found at clintflickerlettering.blogspot.com, and that link will be in the show notes for this episode.
I believe so. I shamefully neglected that blog for years now, but people keep saying how useful they found it. So I leave it up there, even though, like I say, I wish I had time to do more content for it. It's always in the back of my mind. I keep thinking, oh, I should do that. But then, you know, more pressing things like mowing the lawn or whatever just suddenly require my attention. And some, my wife reminds me that I said I'd fix something 6 months ago and still haven't fixed it. So it's
as ever. So, Clint, I'll put that link in the show notes. I'll put the link to Hibernia Press in the show notes as well. If anybody knows about the original artwork from The Tower King, do get in touch with me and Jim and let us know. Great stuff. It's another fantastic collection. And as you say, the brilliant idea of sticking those, you know, the two together would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Well, I reckon you'd get a book that was big enough to be worth printing, and it would look absolutely stunning, I think. I shall. I may quietly start badgering Rebellion, just make a pain in the bum of myself until they give up and do it just to get them to go away.
Keith, if you're listening, that's what we'd like next.
Damn right.
Although obviously, I'm sure he's got loads of plans for 2025. Right. Splendid stuff, Jim. And I look forward to a repeat return to the book club. And also, hopefully, I guess Lawless in Bristol at the end of May will be our next meetup, possibly.
Yeah, that's the next thing. I see the next thing on my calendar. So, and as always, I'm looking forward to that tremendously. It's always a good time at Lawless. So that's a...
It is tremendous, yes. The best convention this side of the Irish Sea, Enniskillen on the other side, obviously. But yeah, it is terrific, Lawless in Bristol, and I look forward to seeing you there and buying you another pint.
I might have to buy you one this time, mate. I mean, it seems to be a bit one-sided, the direction of travel for this beer. I'll buy you one this time.
We'll see what we can do.
Definitely fair.
Great stuff, Jim. Thank you so much for coming back on the book club.
It's always a pleasure, Eamon. I shall have a ponder about what are the obscure corners of the British comic industry we can plunder to have another chat about.
Great stuff. I look forward to it. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, find these links that we've been talking about at Mega City Book Club. Follow us on all of the socials apart from Twitter if you want to see some of the images from The Tower King that we've been discussing in this episode. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you've got a book or an artist or a creator that you'd like to come on the book club and talk about. And until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from me. Thank you, Eamon. Bye.